Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I explore what I call a shifting paradigm in the consciousness of the planet, of humanity, and we are defining our worlds in different ways, and tonight's guest is very much at the forefront of a shift in paradigm.
Channel 4 Britain was lunatic enough to say that something to the effect of Howard Bloom is the next, the Sigmund Freud, Albert Einstein, Charles Darwin, and Isaac Newton of the 21st century, and Gear Magazine was even wackier. It said Howard Bloom may just be the next Stephen Hawking, except he's not just interested in science, he's interested in the human spirit. And then, of course, there was Bonnie DeVarco, who was the archivist for Buckminster Fuller. So she knew Buckminster and his work very well.
And she said,
that was one of the most startling comments, because she said Howard Bloom is a Buckminster Fuller and Arthur C. Clarke of the 21st century.
I guess that's a great way to introduce yourself here on New
Realities.
Yes,
but when I say it, forget that I ever said it. It sounds egotistical as all hell.
I'm here today with Howard Bloom, who, besides writing some amazing books about the Lucifer Principle, the global brain, was it?
Right.
What was that first?
The Lucifer Principle, a scientific expedition into the forces of history.
Right.
Followed by, would you like the others?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, followed by Global Brain,
which
the
was?
Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century, and The Genius of the Beast, a radical revision of capitalism, soon to be joined, actually now joined within the last 3 weeks, by The God Problem,
now
how a godless Cosmos Creates.
Right. Just out now, that is Howard's latest book.
Right.
And The God Problem, when I heard you speak about other things and other shows, I commented to you when I met you at a party.
Right.
That it's really not God that's the problem, it's our assumptions we make about the nature of creation.
You've got it, exactly.
And so, forget God.
Right.
God's not even in the question, because that's some hypothetical would-be what if.
Right.
But what is in the question is how we cognize reality.
Right.
That's why I call the show New Reality.
Right.
So you took five principles in this book and you broke
five
it down.
Five heresies. Right.
One, A does not equal A.
Yes, you got it.
Okay, that's the first one. Let's start there. And the other four is 1 + 1 does not equal 2.
2, right. Number 3 is the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, the law that all things fall apart. Yes, absolutely, totally, and completely wrong.
I'm with you on that. The fourth is?
The fourth is randomness is not as random as you think. This is not a six monkeys at six typewriters universe.
That would never happen.
Right, and number 5, Alan did this to me brilliantly. I don't know where the camera is. It's here somewhere.
Right there.
Okay. Yeah. Alan did this to me brilliantly about 2 weeks ago when we met at a party. And he started reciting some of the key concepts for the book from the book in a way that utterly astonished me. Plus, he had seen beyond what's in the book to the book's extra peripheral visions.
Well, let's hopefully we can get to that tonight.
Yes.
So the fifth principle was?
The fifth principle is information theory is not about information.
In fact,
it misses the mark.
Information theory is about,
we'll go into that.
The structure of consciousness. Okay, so what I get, we have these silly assumptions that have been passed down since Aristotle about the way the nature of the universe is.
Okay, now let me stop you on assumptions, because it's a very important word.
Let's go very slow.
Okay. So I put you in my position in this book. So, Alan, let's imagine this. You are 10 years old.
Okay.
You're in a godforsaken steel town that steel is about to evaporate
to
from.
Buffalo.
Yeah, Buffalo, New York.
Did you really grow up in Buffalo?
Yes, I grew up in Buffalo. No wonder.
I hated that place.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, I understand where you're coming
from. Gorgeous buildings, but no people you can relate to.
Right.
So there you are, stuck in Buffalo at the age of 10. No other kid wants to have anything to do with you when they're throwing some sort of a party or they're doing they've erected a tent in somebody's backyard. Mm-hmm. You are out. They post a sentry on the driveway to tell you cannot even walk up the driveway. When they're putting together a team for a baseball game and they see you coming, they literally pick up all their equipment and move to another location.
So you were like the geek before there were geeks.
The geek before, yes, before there were geeks. Although I think there have always been geeks.
Right. Okay.
But at any rate, one day you're sitting in your big living room with the curtains are always drawn and they're great big velvet curtains. Mm-hmm. The room is dark. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
And it smells outside because of the steel is burning in Buffalo.
Oh, no,
day
not,
and
not
night.
where I was. Okay. Across the street is a Frederick Law Olmsted Park. So it's and behind the house is a Frank Lloyd Wright house.
Oh,
so it's a gorgeous location.
It's in the Albright-Knox Museum.
Tudor house not far from
The Delaware.
Yeah, exactly. There you are, and this book. You know the location of every book in the room. You've grown up with all of these books. And suddenly there's a book in your hands, and you don't know where it came from. It has no location, and you never see it again. And when you grow up and look in Google Book Search, you can't find it. Uh-huh. But the book tells you two of the most important things you've ever seen in your life. They basically, it's as if the author grabs you by the lapel and says, schmuck. Oh, I mean, you're Jewish, so...
I can understand
You're
that,
Jewish if you're me for a day. So, at any rate...
I'm still Jewish.
And the author, right, and the author, but now you're doubly Jewish, okay. And the author says, schmuck, listen to me. There are two basic rules of science. Rule number one, the truth at any price, including the price of your life. And it gives us an example, Galileo, but it tells the story all wrong, thank God. It doesn't tell you that Galileo's buddy was the Pope, and it doesn't tell you that he was given a choice, being burned at the stake, or saying no to all of his, saying that everything he'd written was untrue and living under house arrest.
He did say that.
Yeah, he took the bargain. But it doesn't tell you that. It tells you that Galileo would have been willing to go to the stake like Giordano Bruno, in order to support his truth. And that's what you need to hear, Alan. You need to hear a message of courage, not a message of cowardice. So rule number one, the truth at any price, including the price of your life. Rule number two of science, look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before. Look at things that you and everyone around you take for granted as if you've never seen them before, and then proceed from there. In other words, find your assumptions. Because it's not just questioning. We all have heard of questioning assumptions, and that's a difficult process. But you can't question them until you find them.
Right, but you know our cultural conditioning makes us immune to see. We're hypnotized by the culture to see just one level of reality. So we have to question the whole culture itself. We have to question the language we're using. That frames our reality
in
a very narrow view of what's possible.
Well, this book is designed, and if it achieves its purpose,
The God Problem,
How a Godless Cosmos Creates. This book is designed to take you out of the normal way of looking at things so you can see everything around you in a whole new light, so you can see the assumptions. And in the process of seeing the hidden assumptions, the very skillfully hidden assumptions, assumptions in some cases that have been with us for 2,300 years or more without questioning, it makes you feel like an alien, so you can see these things as if they're strange and hypotheses, not absolutes.
Let's go into that.
Right.
Let's go. So if you say, start off, A does not equal A.
A does not equal A.
Now let me see if I understand
that. Okay, go ahead.
You have A here.
Right.
And then you have the equal, and you have A here.
Right.
Your left hand is not your right hand.
Yes, exactly.
What's here is not there.
You got it. It's
A cannot be A, even though you're calling it A.
That's
so we're assuming that A is A when A here is not A there.
Right, and A equals A is vital to the process we call logic. I mean, I wondered, Alan, you know, it took me until my 58th year or something like that to really dig into this. But I wondered, you know, we talk about reason and logic all of the time, but we never step back and say, what are reason and logic? What are their basic assumptions? Are they really accurate?
Right.
So I went back to the very roots of reason, and I found them in Aristotle. And Aristotle was the guy who basically said A equals A, period. And Ayn Rand has picked up that chant in the last 20 years, maybe 30.
Yeah.
And she has made a basic... it's a creed that is recited by her people as if they are parrots, her followers. A equals A. If A equals A and if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals A. And Ayn Rand says that doubting that A equals A is the very root of everything that's evil, foul, and wrong.
Really?
With this world.
Well, I would love to hear you debate Ayn Rand.
Well, she's dead. It would be difficult, but it would be interesting. If you can get her on the show, I'll come.
Okay. No, but so she... And everyone before her as well said A equals A. This is the theory behind geometry.
It's what Aristotle, what's behind geometry. And Aristotle called it the principle of non-contradiction, that something cannot be true and not be true at the same time.
So because you were implanted at 10 years old with these two basic principles, the truth above everything and look at everything under your nose, you were kind of refurbished to be like a clean slate.
A radical reperceiver. I was basically set up as a radical reperceiver. Why? Because the kids wouldn't let me up the driveway to participate in the games of Doctor or House or whatever they were playing. And I was thrust to the periphery.
They did you a favor.
Yes, but they may have sensed something in me that was off kilter to begin with. I mean, Alan, when I'm at a rock concert, I like to get down in the middle of the audience to feel the whole experience, even though, you know, I have an all-access pass and could go absolutely anywhere.
Right.
And I noticed one day, probably in a John Mellencamp or Prince concert, that when everybody was clapping and I was clapping too, when everybody was going like this, my hands automatically went like this. And when their hands were going like this, my hands automatically went like this. And it wasn't a choice.
Right.
It wasn't a choice at all. In fact, it took real hard looking. It means that... Talk about walking to a different drummer, marching to a different drummer. Apparently, my rhythms are the opposite in certain ways of other people's rhythms, and that's a tremendous advantage. It got me kicked out of every social group imaginable when I was
a kid.
But
it also opens the door as an original thinker. That's why I'm so happy you're on New Realities, because you are, like, the original, the Einstein, the Freud, the Karl Marx of our time.
Well, that's the effort.
No, no. But anyway, because you're a radical...
Reperceiver.
Reperceiver, you took nothing for granted.
That's right.
And so let's start here again with God.
Right. Well, let me give you a little bit more on A equals A.
Or not.
When you're thinking out 1A, let's imagine you think 1A out at 9:01 in the morning, at 9 o'clock in the morning, and the next day at 9:01. It's A, right? A equals A.
You put an A on.
The fact is, in the minute between the thought of the first day and the thought of the second day, or typing the first day on your laptop and then typing the second day, the Earth has moved around its axis 17 miles. The planet has moved around the center of the sun 557 miles. And the sun, complete with solar system and you and me, has marched 864 miles around the core of the galaxy.
And every cell in your body is changing as well.
Yes, right.
So you are never you.
That's right. You're absolutely
right. It's very like Heraclitus. You never
That's it. Now, here, Aristotle, Einstein said that to think originally, you need to contend with somebody. I'm not giving you the exact quote,
but that was
his idea. You need a straw man. And Aristotle had a straw man. And the straw man had been dead for 90 years, but
Heraclitus.
His name was Heraclitus.
Now, Heraclitus was much more the wise sage than Aristotle.
But it's very important.
He said, expect the unexpected, because it's difficult and hard to find.
Right.
That one I live by as far as understanding new realities.
Right. But to set himself up, look, put yourself in Aristotle's shoes. Nobody's ever heard of you. and you know, you grew up in Stagira, which is a godforsaken town that's on the outskirts of the Persian Empire, and it's in the outskirts of the Greek Empire. It's a city of barbarians. You want to make it in the big time in Athens. There's a slot that's been opened ever since Thales. Thales established philosophy.
Right.
And he began to establish the idea that each age has a great man, right?
Right?
Now, to put himself on the stage of attention and contend for that position as a great man, Aristotle had to use every trick in the book.
Right.
And one of those tricks is the name game. The more you associate yourself with people who are already of high stature, the greater your stature becomes. So if you take on the greatest philosopher of the last 100 years, if you take on Heraclitus.
But wasn't Plato the straw man for Aristotle? Because they put those two in opposition all
Plato
the time in Western philosophy.
Plato used Heraclitus as a straw man, and he used Plato as a stepping stone.
So Aristotle used Heraclitus as a straw man to buffer against.
Right.
And then Plato, but weren't his opinions or philosophies in opposition to Plato, who said everything is just kind of idyllic, and Aristotle said, no, everything is concrete? Aren't those two in opposition there?
Aristotle wouldn't have seen it that way, because Aristotle was building on the shoulders. You have to stand on the shoulders of somebody.
So he took Platonic philosophy.
Yes, and he restated it in his own work. And he restated it and credited it to Plato.
Okay.
But it was Aristotle who called those ideal abstractions that Plato was talking about, ideas.
Okay.
We talk about them as archetypes, but Plato didn't talk about them.
But just a little side note, no one understood that Socrates was really a mystic.
Right.
When he would go into these daimonic trances, he was communing with some higher level parts of his own consciousness.
Well, that could easily be, but I have never studied Socrates. It's hard because you've got Socrates only through Plato.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
How do you know what's Plato and what's Socrates?
But the early Platonic dialogues are much more true to the Socratic way of being, I feel.
Right.
Especially if you measure it against Aristophanes, who talks about Socrates in a very, like, you know, fun way,
right,
a very satirical way. But you can get an essence of what the master Socrates was probably like, the humble being and the visionary.
Well, let's go back to A, why A does not equal A. So you could say, Bloom, you idiot. Just because you thought of 1A at this one point and you thought of the second A 17 miles away in terms of the Earth's rotation, that doesn't mean that A is different. What difference does it make? Well, context makes all the difference in the world. For example, William Shakespeare probably uses the letter A in his work somewhere close to 100 million times.
Okay.
And every A has a very different significance because of context. Let's just take the two A's in the word Shakespeare.
Uh-huh.
Each one is pronounced differently. Shake versus spear, one you don't even hear.
Okay, but would you say that A here is, it may not be equal, but it's related?
Here's the deal.
Okay.
The logic built on the premise that A equals A has taken us a long way. It is a very, very valuable tool. Consider it a screwdriver in the mental toolkit.
Okay.
But sometimes...
Where has it taken us, let's say?
It's gotten us... algebra is all based on equation.
And
that's why it's called equations. That little equal sign is...
And what was the thing that it ran up against that it could no longer take us to?
Almost everything.
Okay.
Because our... current way of thinking about things. Brian Greene, you know, Brian Greene's the theoretical physicist who has his own series.
Yeah, his
two series on PBS and everything.
Yeah.
And Brian Greene says, if you could tell me the position of every particle in the cosmos, I would be able to explain the universe to you. Well, what kind of bullshit is that? Here are a few of the things that A equals A.
He just gave Brian Greene
the finger. Right.
If you weren't.
No, he's done a wonderful job with his career, and he's a terrific explainer. And the things he explains are fascinating, so he should be given credit. But the fact is, he's in the very center of the tradition of two traditions. He's in the very center of the tradition of Aristotle, A equals A, Aristotelian logic. And he's also one of those kids who would have been in the backyard when they sent the sentry down the driveway to say, you're not allowed here.
He's one of those guys.
Yeah, one of those guys.
He's a good old boy.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So now, it doesn't allow us to talk about consciousness.
Okay.
It doesn't allow us to talk about emotion. It doesn't allow us to talk about social behavior. It doesn't allow us to talk about emergent properties. And emergent properties are the big kahuna. Emergent properties are the thing that is totally evading everybody in science right now. Well, the idea of back at the in the 1700s, one guy discovered that if you put a bunch of things together, in one case it was scorching mercury, if you did weird things to a metal, you'd get a gas. And the gas had weird properties.
Mm-hmm.
And the gas, he called these things phlogiston and deflogistated air and stuff like that. Two guys discovered these two gases. One was oxygen and one was hydrogen.
Right.
Then it was discovered around 1790 that if you put some of the hydrogen, well, let's do this with A equals A terms, and we'll go to heresy number two, 1 plus 1 equals 2, right? We all know that 1 plus 1 equals 2. We've been taught it ever since we were
and
tiny little kids.
You're saying 1 plus 1 does not equal 2.
And here's where emergent properties come in. Take one bell jar full of hydrogen and one bell jar full of oxygen. They're both gases, right?
Right.
A equals A.
Yes.
Gas equal gas.
Yes.
Put them together. What should you get? 1 plus 1 equal 2. So what should you get?
Two,
twice as much gas.
And you don't. You get a liquid.
Well, it depends.
Oh.
If you decide to light a match and put the match in, what should you get? Well, all you're adding is heat to two gases. Garbage in, garbage out. A's in, A's out. You should just get a slight degree of warming in your two twice as much gas. You don't. You get two emergent properties. One is a thing called an explosion, and the second is this really weird form of matter. It's a form of matter. Now, what's the difference between a gas and this chair? I can't put my hand through this chair, right?
Right.
But I can put my hand through a gas. I'm doing it right now.
Right.
I can't see through this chair arm, but I'm seeing through air right now. So
the in-between state, is that really weird state, isn't
it? Well, but so there's hard stuff and there's gas, right?
Right.
So we just put two gases in with a little bit of heat.
Yeah.
Right? We should have heated two gases. No, whammo, explosion. And this really weird stuff that will soak into your pants and make you very embarrassed if it soaks into the wrong spot, and you will, you know, hesitate to stand for half an hour while it dries out. It will soak into the rug. It will puddle on the chair arm.
It's also the fabric of life itself.
Yes,
you know?
And it's a very weird stuff. And let's go to heresy number four.
Let me just absorb heresy number two.
Okay, right.
You're saying, obviously, in practicality, 1 + 1 does not equal 2. 1 + 1 equals something we can't imagine.
Right. So,
but all the time.
But logic tells us that none of this should happen. Logic, Aristotelian logic, tells us when you add two gases, you should get a gas.
So are you saying not logical?
The universe is partially logical. Logic
it's not Aristotelian logic,
but it's not entirely Aristotelian logic. Aristotelian logic has allowed us to very successfully scratch at a bunch of surfaces. Very successfully. Here's how Aristotle broke it down.
Okay.
And this is where Brian Greene's thinking comes from. Aristotle said that there are these things called elements.
Okay.
And if you break everything down to its elements, and then you find, and he coined a term, he used a metaphor, the dictates that Hammurabi gave you of how to lead your life. Those were called laws.
Okay.
So Aristotle said the task was first to find the elements, then to find the laws of those elements, which he called elementary laws. If you ever wonder where that phrase came from, it came directly from Aristotle, and we haven't been questioning it since.
So there were elementary laws of the universe.
Right, but what he said is, once you understand the elementary laws, you understand everything. Well, that would mean that by understanding the two gases and their properties, you would understand all that comes from them when you combine them and put the match in. But you don't, not at all.
But obviously he missed some basic elementary laws.
He missed the fact that there are emergent properties in this cosmos.
But that he didn't get to the core of the elementary laws behind elements. Obviously, there elements exist in many states that Aristotle was unaware of.
Well, you know, none of us have read the complete works of Aristotle. Okay. And even though I spent 2 years researching and reading Aristotle for this, I concentrated on his metaphysics, and I concentrated on his, oh God, what is it called? I'm going to have to memorize the name of this book.
His poetics.
No. This is a one with a really complicated name. But in the book that I can't remember the name of, thus demonstrating that I'm not the Einstein, Darwin, Newton, and Freud of the 21st century. In this book, there are two vital pages, in which Aristotle lays out the vocabulary of modern science and the method of modern science. And Brian Greene, when he is telling you about wonders on television and making statements about reductionism, Brian Greene doesn't recognize the extent to which he's taking things straight out of Aristotle. For example, Aristotle told you that metaphor is not science.
Uh-huh.
It's not really science.
It is.
Metaphor is all that science is about. When scientists talk about a wave, that's a metaphor. When they talk about a particle, that's a metaphor. How can they say they don't deal in metaphors?
Oh, I see. So that's really what I want this show to be about. How can we think differently? How can we actually structure the nature of reality and see the world in a different way according to some of the fundamental laws you lay out.
Right. No. Well, one way is to read books like this.
But
I'm serious.
Because
every time you read a book, you get into somebody else's head.
Yeah.
And being in somebody else's head, it helps give you a perspective.
Yeah.
Now, if you recognize from the beginning when you're going to read a Jane Austen novel, that one of the things you're looking for is hidden assumptions. Mm-hmm. You're looking for Jane Austen's hidden assumptions. Those would be fascinating to find. But one of the reasons for looking for Jane Austen's hidden assumptions is to find your own hidden assumptions. Mm-hmm. If you know that's part of the journey, that's part of the quest, that's part of the adventure.
Uh-huh. So what were the hidden assumptions that you discovered about yourself in writing this book?
Well, I discovered that I am an outsider. I don't know the reasons. I discovered, it's not in this book. I discovered that I was born in 1943. Uh-huh. That's when America went into the war with Germany and Japan.
Right.
My father had just started a tiny little store in Buffalo, New York. And my father was suddenly yanked off to San Francisco, which in those days, before jet planes, was a four-day train ride, right, day and night away. Not that the Navy was going to let him take that train ride. It only let him take it once. So I had no father. I grew up without a father. Okay, now my mother has to go run the store. That means she's away from home 12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
You're left with the books.
I'm left with a cleaning woman. Now, why it didn't occur to my mother to hire a babysitter, you know, babysitter in the task. I mean, talk about assumptions. There's an assumption hidden in these two different words, cleaning woman and babysitter. Babysitter job means you take care of the baby. Cleaning woman means you take care of the vacuum cleaner.
So
the cleaning women would lock me in a dark passage with a very cold wood floor, and you register that when you're 3 years old, because you're crawling on that cold wood floor behind a baby gate. And you're in the darkness and in the cold, and that's how I spent my first 3 years of life.
So what did that do for you?
Well, it made me an outsider.
Oh, I see. And then making you an outsider also made you think differently about reality.
Exactly.
So let's get back to the book.
Okay, let's get back to the book.
So, I mean, it's okay, but I really want to learn from this conversation how to look at my own assumptions, how to look at the assumptions the culture gives me that thinks something is real or true or beautiful, and try to reevaluate in terms of what I feel.
Well, that's a tricky one, because that goes to, so here I am in science all my life. At the age of 10, I discover the first two rules of science. I go into microbiology and theoretical physics at the age of 10, and eventually decide to jump ship from science. And to spend, I don't realize it's going to be 20 years, but to go off on my own voyage of the Beagle. And my voyage,
Darwin's Beagle.
My voyage of the Beagle doesn't go to the Galapagos Islands. It goes to something strange and exotic that I know absolutely nothing about. It's popular culture. So I start a commercial art studio. It becomes one of the two biggest commercial art studios in avant-garde art on the East Coast.
You started magazines. PR companies.
So I'm on the cover of Art Direction magazine. I'm then hired to edit a magazine. I don't even ask what the magazine is about when I go for the interview. It turns out to be about rock and roll, which I've never really listened to. And I'm up for it, because it sounds like an adventure. Because, Alan, I'm looking, there's a vital step we're skipping here.
Okay,
so again, we're going to put you in my shoes.
And I was already bar mitzvahed.
But you're 12 years old. You're about to have your bar mitzvah. And you suddenly, you read the arguments of Bertrand Russell. They make absolute sense, both to your mind.
What are the
against
arguments?
Against God. It's basically all comes down to the argument that if a complex thing needs something to design it, then who designed the designer of the complex thing? And so on and so forth, an infinite recursion.
So you're saying if the universe is complex, it needs a God that's complex, so who designed God?
Yes, exactly.
And so there's no answer for that.
And there's another argument. And that argument is that if there is a God, he's one of the most death-hungry monsters you have ever seen in your life. Why? Because he invented death. Did God really need to invent death? I mean, mass murder is going on all around you, and you're growing up in the wake of World War II, and you're growing up in the wake of the Holocaust. The Holocaust began the year you were born. And so you're very aware, because I'm putting you, in my position.
The Holocaust began.
So at any rate, the point is that you grow up learning never to let a Holocaust go on. And there's a God who's created a universe of Holocausts. Every creature he's ever given birth to has died. Even stars die, Alan. I mean, that's outrageous.
But maybe death is just a transition, or not what it appears to be anyway.
Well, because I'm a very materialistic...
Where does that get
Well, here's the deal. So you're... You're 12 years old, you realize that you're an atheist, a stone-cold atheist. There's no question about it. It's a matter of faith. It's that basic. And your bar mitzvah is coming up, and you don't want to blow the presents. It's the only party you've ever been invited to. So you keep it in your non-conscious for a while. You don't admit it to yourself. Then, once you've written all the thank you notes, you can confess that you're an atheist.
But you are sort of mystic, though,
have to say. But here's the deal. The real important moment. Your bar mitzvah is at the very end of June. That's only 2 months away from September. What happens to Jews in September? The two highest holidays of the year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So it's a mere 2 months before your parents try to dress you in a suit, throw you in their blue Fraser, drive you down to Richmond Avenue where the synagogue is, and then that's as far as you're going to go, Alan.
You're not going in there.
On to the door frame of the car, and they literally pull you by the ankles, thus threatening to shred your socks.
Okay.
And you suddenly realize something, the second rule of science, the rule by which you must live, is look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before and then proceed from there. Well, your parents obviously have a powerful belief, even though this is the only time of year they go to synagogue, they have a passionate belief in God. You can tell by the way they're tugging on your ankles.
Right. So you go into the synagogue and you look at everything.
No, it isn't that you'll get into the synagogue. The point is that you all of a sudden, all of the stuff you've read about anthropology, and by now you've been in science for 27% of your life. So all the stuff you've read about anthropology shows you that people all over the world believe like your parents do in some sort of supernatural force, an equivalent to a God.
Some sort of fundamental assumption about an unreality that doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, but this means that the thing right under your nose is not under your nose, it's behind your nose. Because if there are no gods in the sky, and there are no gods in the earth, and there are no gods in the lighting system here, or in the plant behind us.
An artificial plant.
Well, even in the plastic behind
okay,
us.
Okay.
Then gods have got to be in here. And your job becomes find the gods inside of us. And
well,
their corollary.
That's where I am in line with Newton, because I do think we have some mystical infinite force. It's just a belief.
Yeah.
And that animates us.
We have experiences of transcendence. We have experiences of awe. We have. I mean, at the age of 16, I had my first out of body experience.
Well, how do you explain that as an atheist?
Oh, that was easy. We worked that out.
It wasn't just the phenomenon of the mind. Maybe
yes,
you were actually.
No, no. We worked that as a phenomenon of the mind.
Really, was not in the body. Is that?
Well, I don't think that's true.
Well, you might want to question that assumption.
But yes. Look, we were operating on the basis of assumptions, and Valerius Geist, who's one of the most important large mammal research specialists, and wrote a landmark book called Life Strategies in 1978, and I worked this out because I had. But that's another.
Okay. Let's get back to the book because I want to go back.
But
to
so
the basic
your job,
assumptions.
One of your jobs is to find the gods inside. Another one of your jobs is to figure out if there is no God as you believe. How? I mean, if no God said, "Let there be light," how did light come to be? Mm-hmm. If no God parted the heavens and the earth, where did the heavens and the earth come from? And no scientist that you know of is trying to answer that question.
Okay. So let's go back to these assumptions.
Right.
So, okay, if there's no... Okay, so let's throw out the God principle.
Right.
And let's start with fundamental observations of reality.
Right.
Okay, so 1 plus 1 does not equal 2. A does not equal A.
Number 3 is, and this fits directly with everything you've just said, number 3 is... The second law of thermodynamics, one of the holiest laws in science, the law of entropy, the law that all things fall apart, that all things tend toward disorder, is so dead wrong, it's ridiculous.
I'm with you in that. You know why I'm with you?
Yeah.
Because entropy only exists within a closed system.
Right.
Obviously, the universe is an open system because something came from nothing. We are being fed. This is my
But this is accepting the assumptions of entropy, that there are closed and open systems.
Well, there can't be a closed system because everything seems to be connected to everything else.
Yes.
And we're obviously
so where's the open system? I mean, where's the closed system?
There is no closed system,
right.
So there is no entropy.
Right.
I'm with you on that
one. But remember, the whole idea of entropy came out of a steam engine problem, and that was how to stop the leaks in a steam engine.
Well,
so the universe was then compared to a steam engine, but because science caught this plague from Aristotle of believing that metaphor is unscientific, it buries its metaphors. And when you bury your metaphors, you can't question them as easily as you could when they're out in the open. And it's that steam engine metaphor that's slightly out of date.
Right.
Just slightly out of date. Because what happened when you put the two gases together? Did you get a chaos of disorder?
Right.
You got the opposite.
So we're at the edge now of some major revolution in thought, in science, in consciousness, whatever you want to call it. What are the new principles that we can lay down for a new foundation of seeing the world?
Look, the form of a photon is a mystery. Now, science is not regarding it as a mystery. Well, hey, the second law of science is look at things right under your nose. Look for the things that you and everybody around you take for granted.
It is a mystery. It obviously is because they've never seen it.
So what does it do? It's a recruitment strategy. It goes like this, right?
Okay.
And it goes like this 570 trillion times a second. That is bloody survivalist instinct on the part of something. It knows where to stop.
The photon.
The photon. It knows where to stop to, at its amplitude. It knows where to stop down here at its minimum. Then it goes to an amplitude again.
Does it know, or is that an emergent property?
It's both. It's an emergent property.
I wouldn't say it knows.
It doesn't know. It doesn't have a brain. It doesn't have a consciousness.
Right.
And yet it persists. And to say that persistence only belongs to humans, when we have this thing that's blipping, it's doing this.
But we are complex. I mean, some people compared consciousness to a radio.
Right.
As if, you know, you're picking up consciousness
right.
through your brain, but
right.
it's not being generated from the brain,
right.
just like sound.
And we compare it to software.
It's made by the sound is picked up, but it's not generated
right.
necessarily by the radio.
Well, sound is a recruitment strategy.
Or whatever's
sound is another one of these waves.
So
sound
this recruitment strategy is what I'm trying to understand. What is that?
Well, that's a good question.
It's
when I finished writing this book,
yeah.
and I was called on to do, I think it was Andrew Stein and Ken Wilber event.
Mm-hmm.
It was
Andrew Cohen.
Yeah, Andrew Cohen. Yeah, thanks.
Right, right.
I took material from this book and put it together as an essay on immaterial things, on the material power of immaterial things.
Mm-hmm.
There are forms that are able to sustain themselves. There are forms that have rigorous persistence.
Uh-huh.
There are forms that maintain an identity.
Mm-hmm.
There are forms that are utterly promiscuous and grab one batch of matter and leave it behind almost instantly.
Right.
Some, like your identity and mine, leave matter behind a little bit more slowly.
Right.
But we still do that.
Right.
And what the hell these are is the mystery. But you cannot solve a mystery until you establish what it is.
And you establish principles whereby the world functions so you have a place to frame the mystery.
Right.
And you're throwing out all the old principles because they are not true.
Well, they're keeping them, but trying to give you new tools. I'm trying
okay.
to show you their limitations.
Okay, and you are. And
yeah.
you are. I'm happy you are.
Right.
Because A does not equal A. I know that for sure.
Right.
And 1 plus 1 does not equal 2.
And you definitely know law number 3, or heresy number 3,
that
entropy is...
I do. I never agree with that. And
right.
law
it's
number 4 would be...
Would be randomness is not as random as you think.
So what is randomness?
Well, again... Take a look at that photon that starts out at the very beginning of the universe 13.72 billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still trekking.
Yeah.
It's still doing its thing. Now, if you multiply 540 trillion times 1 second, times all the seconds between then and now, that's how long this thing has been keeping it up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is a very steady pattern. It is a very steady process. It is not at all random. It knows exactly where to stop on its amplitude. It knows exactly where its minimum is. And then it goes back and does exactly the same thing again. Is that a random universe? Okay, imagine you and I are sitting at a coffee table.
I don't think the universe is random either.
Well, but when you're in the areas that I'm in, one of my areas is evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology. You know, I founded the Group Selection Squad in evolutionary biology
uh-huh.
in 1995, and we legitimated a concept that's very important called group selection
mm-hmm.
that had been considered a curse and a heresy
mm-hmm.
up until then. And when you're working in evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology, you come up against absolute randomness and the six monkeys at six typewriters all the time.
That is so ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, meaning, say, that if you had enough typewriters, enough monkeys, you could reproduce the works of Shakespeare, which seems totally illogical,
well,
even if there were.
Yes, and somebody actually tried the experiment in the last 4 years, and they didn't even get words. I mean, they got a lot of excrement on typewriter keys.
I mean, so obviously
they literally got a lot of excrement on typewriter keys.
But obviously, the universe is not random,
right?
But it's also, according to you, not made from some great power that wants to keep it all together. So
no.
it's somewhere in between these.
Alan, let's take a look at the intelligent design hypothesis for just a second.
Okay.
What is it that a designer does? A designer first visualizes something. There are roughly 40 visual centers in the brain.
Right.
Vision is a very, very complex mechanism.
Oh, and you're saying that's not what the universe does. The universe does not visualize.
It doesn't have to have 40 vision centers the way we do.
Right.
It doesn't have to come up with a picture of things and then
apply
that picture. So how does
the universe create, according to you?
Well, you're back in my shoes, you poor baby.
Okay.
And you're 19 years old.
Okay. I'm not 12 anymore.
Yeah.
That was an awful time.
And you've gotten, yes, that was an awful time. And you've not that 19 was any better, but you have gone off to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, from Buffalo, New York.
Reed College, 1961.
Yes,
you opened your book.
Your parents have packed you on a train, and you spent 3.5 days getting out there. And And it's the first day of the math class. Reed, now Reed has a couple of characteristics to be aware of. The median SATs in your class are higher than the median SATs at Harvard, Caltech, and MIT.
That's it's why you highest. Went there, right?
I suppose so. I mean, I was attracted by the idea of a very free-form small school.
So you went to Reed.
A very progressive school.
Okay, here we are in Reed, 19
years
old.
Yeah, right. Okay. You're confused. It's the first day of class. You're sitting there with 11 other students around a big conference table, and you're waiting for the professor, and you smell her coming down the hallway before you see her. It's not that she doesn't take baths. It's that in those days, the reproductive technique, when we didn't have computer printers, was called mimeograph paper. It was a chemical process, and it makes this very sweet, very pungent smell.
Oh, I like that blue paper, the blue ink
exactly.
on that.
That's
it.
It did
make a great smell.
Right, it was an addictive odor.
It did.
So you smell the mimeograph paper coming down the hallway, and she steps to the front of the table, and she hands this pile of papers to the student on her right and tells him to pass it around. So we all get one of these pieces of paper. So you've got one too, Alan.
Okay.
You poor baby. And you look at this thing and it's only half a sheet of paper.
Uh-huh.
It's 165 words.
Uh-huh.
It's these five rules. Now, they're utterly incomprehensible. You don't understand a word. But that's all they are, is 165 words and five rules.
Uh-huh.
And your task for the rest of the year is every week, these are called Piano's Axioms.
Mm-hmm.
And again, simple rules equals axioms. And your job every week is to derive another corollary from these axioms. And by the end of the year, you've got everything you ever learned in grammar school about mathematics. You've got addition, subtraction, multiplication,
division.
Okay, so
what are you telling me?
I'm telling you that eight textbooks worth of math were implicit in 165 words. So that's when you come up with something you call corollary generator theory. And your corollary generator theory is maybe the universe started out with just a handful of simple rules. Three, four, five. And then every Planck unit of time does another homework assignment.
Uh-huh.
Except there are 10 with 43 zeros after it, Planck units of time in a second.
Right.
That's a lot of
homework.
So you're
saying the universe perhaps is creating rules all the time?
No, the universe is extracting the possible from what's implicit in those rules.
Well, this is the heart of your argument.
Yes.
Now, this is really what I want to go. So,
right.
Okay, so what would be the first initial rules that you're saying the universe...
Well, I think they are these. I think they're attraction and repulsion and a whole bunch of derivatives that will arrive.
Some people call that electromagnetism and gravity, Nassim Haramein.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, back to the, we're going to sit you at a coffee table, you and me.
Am I still 19?
No. Oh. You're now you.
Oh, I'm
and,
me. Okay.
Yeah, okay. And we're at a coffee table at the beginning of the universe, and there never has been a universe, and we're sitting there in what one
well, I won't
writer
ask you
calls,
how there's a coffee table,
yeah, calls the
okay.
potential. Yeah,
okay,
right,
okay,
exactly.
Okay.
I have to go along with
okay.
my...
Okay, I'm going along with your...
My literary conceit here.
Okay.
And I'm a crusty old fart, and I don't believe in anything. And you are the young visionary. After all, you were born in the 1950s. I was born in the 1940s.
Makes sense.
Okay.
But there's no universe. There's nothing. We're just
there's
sitting
nothing.
On a coffee
There's absolutely
table. Okay,
nothing.
Okay.
And we've swilled down more hundreds of cups of coffee, possibly thousands of cups of coffee, than I care to imagine
I mean,
the bill
poet,
for.
You're a poet, but I'd like you to get to the point. I mean, it's great poetry. Great way to frame
well,
your story.
I want you to see what happens.
Okay.
So you say, you know, I got this feeling over there. Not that there is a there, because there's no time and no space.
Mm-hmm.
But over there, I predict that a pinprick, Paul, smaller than a pinprick, is going to erupt at any second now. And it's going to go unfurling. It's going to unfurl a sheet at speeds beyond belief. And I know, this is lunatic. I mean, you know, how many tens of thousands of cups
how
of coffee have we consumed?
How does nothing come from something?
Yeah,
so
right.
I'm saying there's
and
nothing
there,
there
been,
suddenly there's something
All of
there.
A sudden, there's something. All of a sudden, there is a sheet of space and time, and it's unfurling at a rate that is utterly beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make another one of your predictions.
How did I know that if I mean...
Oh, well, it's just your crazy imagination,
okay,
Alan. You've
so
been like this since you were a kid. There's no stopping you. I mean, your parents weren't able to control you.
So
how in the world am I going to control you?
That's how something comes from nothing.
Yeah, right. This is why I take you to coffee all
thank
the time.
Thank you. Okay.
So at any rate, and then you make another of your wacky predictions. Okay, I grant you that a pinprick smaller than a pinprick all of a sudden came from absolutely nowhere and nothing.
Okay.
And that it began unfurling a sheet of these two qualities that didn't exist before, called space and time. What the hell are they?
Okay.
With speed, what the hell is that? Or energy, if you want to call speed that, because that's what speed is.
Okay.
Space, time, and energy.
Okay.
And you say... any second now. You know the way a rain cloud precipitates in raindrops and hail?
Mm-hmm.
Any second now, that sheet of space and time is going to precipitate in things. And I go, Alan, listen to me. No.
You
got one prediction right? Don't get a swelled head about this, Alan. Look at what we see before us. All it is space, time, and energy. And you're saying this is going to precipitate in things? Alan, there never have been things. Mm-hmm. There never will be things. That's why we call it a nothing.
Tell these guys
right?
Yes,
you got that?
Yes.
Okay. And all of a sudden, precipitating, we're about to get back to the six monkeys and six diapers,
right, so bear with me.
All of a sudden, from the nothingness, precipitates the very first things.
Mm-hmm.
And they are quarks and leptons.
Okay, so now, you're saying the emergent property of this thing that first unfolded was quarks and leptons, but the emergent property of nothing was this something.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so...
Yes, you've got it. Well,
now,
one plus one, wait, I'm losing it.
Zero plus zero equals something.
No. A equals A.
Yeah.
You're telling me that this is going to that space and time is going to precipitate in things.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, A equals A. I'm mm-hmm. telling you, 1 plus 1 equals 2. Add space and time to space and time, and all you get is space and time. Garbage in, garbage
out. You get things. I say that.
We're going to get things. Now, here's where we get to the six monkeys at six typewriters.
Okay.
All of a sudden, a blizzard of things, roughly 10 with 88 zeros after it, 88 zeros. Roughly 10 with 88 zeros things come emerging from nothing. Now, if this were a random universe, if this were a six monkeys at six typewriters universe, if this were the kind of universe that my friends in evolutionary biology are constantly referring to, then 10 with 88 zeros after it things, there'd be 10 with 88 zeros after it different kinds of things.
Right.
And they would have nothing to do with each other. Absolutely nothing to do with each other.
Right.
They would have no way of connecting whatsoever. But that's not what happens, Alan.
What happens?
The quarks come out, for example, in only 16 different forms. 16 different forms? Only 16
that
different
forms?
That we
know of, though.
Well, that we're not even sure we know about quarks, to tell you the truth.
Right.
Everything we're talking about right now is courtesy of our current science.
Right, and that is so such a childish story. I mean, it's obviously, you can't tell me a story based on a children's story and expect to paint a picture of the world.
Oh, I certainly can, and that's what every physicist around is expecting. In fact, they keep calling what they're after a grand unified theory of everything.
Right, but you know what Samuel Butler called science?
Yeah.
Man's ignorance of man's ignorance.
Right. Well, of course, how do you tell an intelligent man by the number of things he knows he doesn't know? In other words, a stupid man believes he knows everything, and the more intelligent an intelligent man gets, the more questions he's befuddled by.
So, I mean, but really it seems like you have a sort of in-between theory of breaking down the old science that obviously isn't true, but yet to conceptualize the new rules
of
a science that could explain a lot more than our science.
I'm trying to get scientists to open their mind about even something as simple as a photon.
Right.
And even, look, it's when you don't fail to see the mysteries that you become blind and ignorant.
Right. But by seeing their assumptions, they could formulate, or science and civilization could formulate a new direction.
And I'm saying that we already have one in the computer. That is to say, once computers throw equations aside, and once they begin dealing with things like fractals and John Conway's Game of Life and Stephen Wolfram's elaborations on John Conway's Things of Life, then all of a sudden we're dealing with a reproducible medium that doesn't need equations, but a reproducible medium in which emergent properties begin to spill forth.
Observing the emergent properties, we can predict patterns of emergence.
We can get closer to predicting patterns of emergence. We can come first. The first step is always outline the mystery. The first step is build the corral, even if there are no ponies.
But you know what Terence McKenna says? He says it's the increase in novelty that perpetuates the mystery.
And he's absolutely right.
So novelty is unpredicted, except we can predict novelty.
Well, I'm talking about science's obligation to understand and predict novelty. Until we can do everything, we're not science. Look, the point of science, once you throw it aside, is to challenge God. What do I mean? The point of science is to become omnipotent.
Right.
The point of science is to become omniscient.
You're much more of a mystic than you let people on.
Well, I've been called, David Swindell at PJ Media says I'm a material mystic, and he's damned right.
Yeah, I think you are, because you're looking at emergent properties, whatever they may be.
Right.
And you're not being surprised by something out of left field. You're
right.
Actually,
I'm inviting things from left field.
Exactly.
I'm trying to get you to see that if you look at left field very carefully, you'll see more astonishments out there than you ever imagined before.
So wait, the fifth assumption, just to kind of wrap it up as far as the layout of the book, is...
Well, information theory has been the big thing for the last 40 or 50 years.
What is it?
And information technology is a $1 trillion...
Theory
okay,
itself?
Information theory is not about information.
But what
okay,
is
here's
it?
Here's Claude Shannon. It's Claude Shannon in 1942 is hired by Bell Telephone. And he's hired by Bell Telephone. Remember, Bell Telephone has a history of hiring very smart people. Bell Telephone scientists have won more Nobel Prize winners by the late 1960s than any other basic research facility funded by a private company.
Okay.
So they had a problem. They had 146 million miles of copper cable.
Okay.
Now, to make money, they have to send messages over this copper cable.
Okay.
And they're running into the limits of the copper cable, even with 146 million miles of the stuff.
Okay.
So they want to know how to pack more information into copper cable. And they hire a mathematician to figure it out. Now, he's not just any mathematician. He's a mathematician who built his first telegraph system when he was a kid and who's into juggling, which is transporting things from one hand to the other and getting them in order and stuff like that.
He comes up with a
mathematical formula.
Uh-huh.
And the mathematical formula is almost identical to the mathematical formula that's used for entropy. And Alan, what do I think of entropy?
You don't like it.
No,
at all.
I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so.
But it's almost exactly the same formula. And as inaccurate as it is when applied to the entire universe, when it's applied to just copper cable and trying to get an electrical signal down the copper cable.
It does work.
Oh, it works. It helps
because
you.
Because it's a closed system. It'll break down over
longer
distances.
Well, but it helps you figure out how to stop noise.
Wait,
and it helps
so you're
you figure
saying
out
the signal that was being sent over this long distance was starting to decay. It wasn't intact.
No, it's not that it wasn't intact. It's that if I were able to get 15 signals down that cable, I wanted to know how to get 150 signals down that cable and increase my profits.
Okay, so they figured, this mathematician figured out
how to compress. He figured out a mathematics that allows for MP3s, that allows for sound compression.
And if you say that information theory is not about information, it's about
It means it's only about a signal going down a copper cable. It's not about
compression.
It's not about anybody having an intention to send a message, and it's not about anybody at the other end receiving and interpreting a message. So one day, it's 1998, I think it was, and I have this friend, Eshel Ben Jacob, and when Eshel came from Israel to visit me out in Brooklyn, I was sick in bed for 15 years, so I was stuck in my bed.
Okay.
And Eshel and his wife sat down at the foot of the bed, and Eshel's wife said, "Do you have the latest copy of the Scientific American?" Well, I had everything spread out around me on the mattress, including the latest copy of the Scientific American, and because what I would do is automatically just turn to the table of contents to mark up the things that I wanted to read, I never saw the cover. She said, "Okay." So I took it out from under my right thigh, and there it was, open to the table of contents. She said, "Look at the cover." I looked at the cover. It's this absolutely gorgeous graphic. I couldn't exactly tell what it was, but gorgeous.
Uh-huh.
It's Eshel's work.
Okay.
Now, because Eshel at the time was working on, he was the head of the condensed matter physics department at the University of Tel Aviv. He was the head of the Israel Institute of Physics, whatever it's called, their Institute of Physicists, their National Institute of Physicists. And he was working in microbiology to see if this pattern was a bacterial colony.
Okay.
And it was a fractal pattern. And he wanted to know a very simple thing. Are these bacteria spreading out in fractal forms because of inanimate laws, the kind of laws that make fractal inside those stones you see at a lapidary shop that are cut
or
in half and polished?
Or organic laws.
Or are there laws that pertain to life?
Or inorganic laws govern life as
well? Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So what did he discover?
What he discovered was that bacteria have a collective intelligence, that they're individual processors for all practical purposes, that are networked in one of the biggest massive parallel processed
So they're parallel processed. They have independent intelligence and collective intelligence.
Right. So, but the point, that's not the point of the story.
The point
of the story is that one day, Eshel sends me a message, and he says, "If you can figure out the definition for information, then you will have solved the problem of the creativity of the cosmos." And it takes me 2 weeks because I'm very slow with some of these things. And then I come back to Eshel with the definition of information. And the definition of information is anything that an interpreter can interpret.
Well, you know what I would say? Information, if you break it down, is formation, patterns. It's the ability to digest and recognize patterns in the environment, take them in, and to recognize them.
Right. Well, you're right. And yeah. And how do you know that something has recognized something else? Mm-hmm. If you're sitting at a telephone and you're listening to a voice, I can't hear that voice necessarily, okay. but I can see if you're taking down notes. I can see if you get up from the...
So what does it all have to do with information theory and your book about the God problem?
Okay. Information theory, when Claude Shannon came up with this magic equation for squeezing stuff down a copper wire, squeezing messages, uh-huh. he wanted to call it entropy. Why did he want to call it entropy? Because it was almost exactly the same formula as the formula for entropy.
Okay.
And then he talked to a guy named Warren Weaver. And Warren Weaver was at the Rockefeller Foundation in charge of some sort of scientific program there.
Okay.
And Warren Weaver said, no, don't call it that. Call it information. And then in the two articles that laid out information theory mm-hmm. In two issues of...
Okay.
Oh, my. Okay. In two issues of the Bell Telephone in-house magazine, Warren Weaver made a very crucial statement. He said, don't mistake our form of information for meaning. Our form of information is a special technical engineering sense of information. Well, Warren, I got news for you. There is a word called information in the English language. Mm-hmm. And information includes the stuff that you were just talking about and the stuff I was just talking about, a response and interpretation.
But what does that have to do with this understanding, the new way of understanding the world?
Well, let's take a look at those first seconds of the universe, okay?
Okay.
You're the madman and I'm the crotchety person.
Right.
So these things appear. And you say, these things are going to show a social rule book. These things are going to show sociality. Mm-hmm. And they're going to show that they know who to get together with and who
they're
to separate
show
from.
Relationship.
Yeah.
From atoms to molecules to elements to people.
And I'm going to tell you that's crazy. Mm-hmm. All these are things.
Right.
And you're telling me that they have this anthropomorphic thing called relationships.
Or associated,
you're
going to
tell me that, and more, you're going to tell me that they have this anthropomorphic thing called communication and meaning.
Right.
That they actually interpret each other's signals. This is crazy. And guess what? They do. Instantly. Uh-huh. Two quarks that are sufficiently like each other flee from each other. That's called repulsion.
Right.
Two quarks that are sufficiently different gang up together and become fused permanently together.
Okay. Now let's sum it all up.
Yes.
Because we're almost
okay.
out of time. We've talked for about an hour
yes.
and a half or something like that. Let me see. So we have these assumptions about the world and we need to reevaluate. I mean, you've broken down the old assumptions.
Right.
But you haven't replaced, the only thing you've replaced it with is the hypothesis that there are emergent properties and we have yet to create laws for
right.
emergent properties.
Right.
But we can see that by following our assumptions, we've reached a dead end.
And that there is a new frontier opening.
And the
new frontier is being opened by computer simulation. And that new frontier will give us the tools to get beyond A equals A. It will give us the tools to get beyond 1 plus 1 equals 2. In fact, it already is. It's been doing that ever since Benoit Mandelbrot went to IBM in 1964 and began to use computers to make these incredible gaudy pictures
emerge, called
fractals.
So what is the new kind of paradigm? Where are we moving into as a new worldview based on new assumptions?
The new worldview is based on we're at the lip of a new frontier. It's your job to question your assumptions and see if you can see things from unique points of view. It's your job to see the obvious. You know, the Babylonians made circles with compasses and they used them as decorative objects, but they never uploaded the circle to the toolkit of the mind. They never made it a concept. It was only the Greeks that made it a concept. The Babylonians had no circles in their minds.
So what
it's your job, Alan,
to
look at the things right under your nose and figure out how you can make them new toolkits for the human mind to explore this vast new frontier of emergence.
Thank you. I think it's the creative mind, the artists, the philosopher, the scientists, the Einsteins, the people who are willing to look at things and let go of the old.
But I got a message for the audience, and that is the Einsteins, the creators, the fantastical wizards who come up with the new tools by seeing the obvious right under their nose, that's you. Also, this validates both Aristotle and, what's his name?
Plato.
Heraclitus. Heraclitus. Because both of them were right.
Mm-hmm.
It is very useful to look at A as A. It's extremely useful.
Right.
However, it's extremely useful to know the entire time that A does not equal A. Why? Because the river is always changing.
Assumptions we make have created a world where we've locked ourselves into a box, really.
Right, but we're the ones who are capable of getting beyond the box.
Thank you. Tell people how to find you.
Okay, it's howardbloom.net. And that's it. It's howardbloom.net.
Thank you, Howard, for taking the time.
Oh, well, it's been great fun. I was amazed when you started spouting the stuff from this book.
Well, you know, I think it's so important that we throw out all our assumptions
right.
and start to build the world from scratch.
Right.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and if you want to contact me at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you for listening.